Hello everyone and welcome to Amanpour. Here's what's coming up.
I am President of the United States of America, and the buck stops with me.
Yet Biden puts the blame squarely on desperate Afghans. I asked former Defense Secretary Mark Esper whether there was a way to avoid America's humiliating withdrawal. Then, she was almost killed by the Taliban. Now, Nobel Peace Prize winner Malala Yousafzai fears for Afghan women and girls. Also ahead.
We want more girls and women to be in decision-making positions.
Tennis legend Billie Jean King joins me with her new memoir, All In, about her lifelong fight for equality on and off the court.
Welcome to the program, everyone. I'm Christiane Amanpour in London. The Taliban laid on the charm offensive today, just 2 days after taking control of Afghanistan, holding a press conference in the capital, Kabul, where they congratulated themselves and the nation for what they called their victory. And they promised that they won't hold grudges.
We don't want Afghanistan to be a battlefield. Today, the fighting is over. Whoever was against the opposition has been given blanket amnesty. The fighting should not be repeated.
But many desperate Afghans simply aren't buying that. Just take a look at this photo of some 640 civilians crammed into a US cargo plane, which then transported them from Afghanistan to Qatar. NATO leader Jens Stoltenberg has announced that it will be stopping support for the nation. And he also pinned the blame for this turn of events on the Afghan government.
Ultimately, the Afghan political leadership failed to stand up to the Taliban and to achieve the peaceful solution that Afghans desperately wanted. This failure of Afghan leadership led to the tragedy we are witnessing today. At the same time, we need to have an honest, clear-eyed assessment of NATO's own engagement in Afghanistan. Despite our considerable investment and sacrifice over two decades, the collapse was swift and sudden.
But is that in fact the whole story? And how will President Joe Biden's role be judged? In his speech to the American people overnight, he showed no second thoughts about his decision despite the Taliban takeover. And allies in the UK and Europe are now asking themselves whether this might in fact be Biden's America First moment. Joining me now in an exclusive interview is the former U.S. Defense Secretary, Mark Esper. He served under President Donald Trump. Mark Esper, welcome to the program. So much to ask you about. But first, let me start with the obvious response to Joe Biden and perhaps Jens Stoltenberg as well. Was there a choice between what Biden claimed would be an all-out war if the U.S. stayed any longer than Trump promised with the Taliban, or what actually just happened? What do you believe could have mitigated a total takeover by the Taliban?
Well, first of all, hello, Christiane. Good to see you again, and it's a pleasure to be here on the show with you. Let me say that, yes, of course, there were more options between the two binary choices presented by the president. Just better planning and extending the timeline and taking a more thoughtful approach and not relying on simple assumptions would have prevented this disastrous outcome that we're seeing unfolding behind us right now, before us right now. It's a humanitarian crisis that I fear is only going to grow worse in the coming days and weeks.
Let me ask you a very pointed question. Again, President Biden and the U.S. administration is putting the blame squarely on the Afghan government, now fallen, and the Afghan forces, which you have spent, in terms of the United States, 20 years trying to step up, basically saying they had no will, it was their fault, we can't fight and win for them if they're not going to fight. Others have pointed out that the Afghan forces have fought and that just in the last few years alone, they lost a total of 45,000 people. Do you believe that it was entirely the fault of the Afghan forces and government?
No, absolutely not, Christiane. Look, clearly the Afghan people deserved better political leadership than what they've had over the past 20 years. And we saw the Afghan soldiers, many of whom fight bravely on the battlefield with the United States and allied support. But to put this all on them is just shifting the blame. The fact is, President Biden owns this. He owns the mess, the catastrophe that has been created over the past several weeks, couple weeks, and should own up to it. And really, at this point, we have to remedy the situation. We have to make sure that the airfield is secured, which I understand it is. But now we have to think about how do we go out and identify, locate, and help bring back the up to 15,000 Americans who are in country, the State Department and other U.S. government employees. We have to think about how do we bring back our Afghan partners, many who risked their lives over the past two decades to help the United States and its allies. So the president could cut through this paperwork, bring these folks out of the country, and take them to another third country, take them to Guam, wherever. But we need to take care of them. And then we should think about how do we organize an international effort to really put the pressure on the Taliban to mitigate this emerging humanitarian crisis. And then finally, I would be remiss if I didn't say we really need to cobble back together our best intelligence assets and resources to make sure we know what's happening on the ground in Afghanistan so it doesn't once again become a safe haven for terrorists to attack America. After all, that's the entire reason why we went there in the first place in 2001.
So let me take a few of those points. The Afghan spokespeople, their leadership, they've had very public press conferences. They are clearly trying to reach the U.S. and the international community with all their promises, and they are seeking international legitimacy. So to your points, they have pledged amnesty, not only to former Afghan forces, but to all of those civilians who are desperate, and we've seen the pictures, to get out. They have also pledged not to allow Afghanistan to be a terrorist safe haven again, as it was when they were last in charge. Do you believe that?
Well, I don't believe anything the Taliban says. We shouldn't trust them, but we need to do our best to verify everything that they're doing. Look, it's clear because some of CNN's folks have done some really good reporting from the streets of Kabul. But out in the city and the provinces, people are scared. They're intimidated. We hear isolated examples of brutality by the Taliban. And we need to see how that develops. But in the meantime, we can't wait. We need to organize, again, an international effort to urge the Taliban to obey, basic human rights and fundamental principles and hold them to what they're saying and verify that they will indeed do so.
Secretary Esper, I need to ask you, of course, the $10,000 million question, and that is about the president who you served under, Donald Trump, because this all began with Donald Trump wanting to pull all U.S. forces out by Christmas and the whole Doha process. In your tweets since the Taliban takeover, you have said that it's both Trump and Biden who own this. You've said by pressing for a precipitous withdrawal of U.S. forces rather than leveraging that military muscle to compel Taliban compliance with the 2020 peace agreement, both presidents hastened the Afghan government's collapse. The outcome was not inevitable, which is why, as Secretary of Defense, I formally opposed Trump's push to further reduce, then hastily withdraw U.S. troops last fall. I recommended we suspended our departure until the Taliban started meeting their side of the deal. So, again, this was started under your administration, the president you served. Can you take us into the conversations that were underway that even imagined that this would result in anything other than what we've seen today?
Well, first of all, there were a series of United States presidents, certainly beginning with President Obama, who wanted to see America withdraw from Afghanistan. And I think at the end of the day, that was the right policy objective and remains to be the case. And I said so. Second, just because negotiations began under the Trump administration does not ignore the fact that, again, President Biden owns the situation, the implementation of his withdrawal that we now see unfolding before us. But that said, the Trump administration signed an agreement with the Taliban in February of 2020. It was a political agreement that was based on a premise that I and many others inside and outside the government shared, and that was that the only way forward was going to be a political agreement, not a military solution imposed by the United States and the Afghan government, but a political solution. And the Taliban signed up to that. We agreed to make reductions in our forces. At the same time, they committed to not allow, as you mentioned earlier, Afghanistan to become a safe haven for terrorists to attack the United States. They made some other commitments as well. And I was very clear at the time that this agreement had to be conditions-based. In other words, both sides needed to meet their ends of the agreement. Now, the good news for the United States military is we were planning reductions anyways. At the time, we were above 13,000 troops. We had planned to go down to around 8,600 or so by the summer. And so with those caveats and conditions in mind, we proceeded. I thought that despite it not being a perfect deal or a great deal, it was a good enough deal. And we actually had Afghans later in the summer talking to one another, which I thought was an achievement. My concern was that President Trump, by continuing to want to withdraw American forces out of Afghanistan, undermined the agreement, which is why in the fall, when he was calling for a return of U.S. forces by Christmas, I objected and formally wrote a letter to him, a memo, based on recommendations from the military chain of command and my senior civilian leadership, that we not go further, that we not reduce below 4,500 troops unless and until conditions were met by the Taliban. Otherwise, we would see a number of things play out, which are unfolding right now in many ways. That, of course, was just a few weeks or a week or so before I left office. But that's the state of play. Now, that said, President Biden coming into office, he was not necessarily bound to continue the Trump plan. He was not necessarily bound to implement the political agreement. He could have taken, as he did, a completely or a different path. He could have tried to go back to the table with the Taliban and renegotiate. He could have demanded, as I argued, that they agree to the conditions they established or that they agreed to in the agreement, and that we use military power to compel them to do that. So that gets back to your first question. I think there were more options available to President Biden and his administration than simply continuing the withdrawal of U.S. forces and doing it in such a precipitous and such a poorly planned way that we now see this crisis right before our eyes.
I'm going to get further down into the military miscalculations in a bit, but first I want to continue to ask you about the president that you served, because this is relevant. Do you believe that President Trump had a full understanding of what actually all this meant, you know, in the field? That he, you know that the peace negotiations, and you've just said it, were with the Taliban, cut out the Afghan government for the first part, and basically, you know, was just with the Taliban, undermining the Afghan government. You also, you know, well, do you believe that Trump had an understanding of actually what was going on? And do you think, or do you know, whether there were any election considerations in terms of his desire to pull U.S. forces out even more rapidly?
Look, I'll just speak for myself and DOD, and I will tell you that we were very clear-eyed about what we could do, about the credibility of the agreement, about our trust in it, and about what would happen or not happen as we looked ahead. So I think we had a very sober assessment of the situation. I was convinced that a conditions-based process was the way forward, and also believed at the same time that a political solution was the only way ahead, which is why I supported the agreement that we set forth. And I think my counterpart, Secretary of State Pompeo, shared many of those same views. So I think we were very clear-eyed about the process and also about the way going forward and what it would mean for the United States, our security, and the Afghan people. Again, I go back to at the beginning of the day, the reason why we went into Afghanistan was to remove al-Qaeda and ensure that that country no longer became a safe haven for terrorists to attack the United States. And we got to give great thanks to our American service members, our diplomats, and others in the United States government, and our allies, by the way, for who 20 years they protected our country. They brought bin Laden to justice, and they made sure that terrorists did not have a safe haven in that country.
And since you haven't talked much about what you euphemistically call leaving the administration, you were in fact fired by the president. And I want to ask you, because at the time you said something like, you know, God forbids a yes person replaces me. What did you think a quote unquote yes person might do? Did the president ever ask you to do anything or make any decision or take any action that you considered dangerous, reckless, or possibly even illegal concerning the military?
Well, look, Christiane, I would never do anything that is illegal, immoral, unethical, and inappropriate as well, as best I could determine each of those to be, and I never did. I left the administration with my head held high. I was proud to serve my country once again. And I think we at DOD did everything we could to advance America's security abroad and made good progress on that. So there will be future times to talk about deeper issues, and I'll promise to come back on your show at some point and do that. But like I said, I'm very proud of DOD and what we did during my tenure, and thought that we did a lot of important things to keep America safe and to protect our country and to live up to our oath to the Constitution in the process. So I'll just leave it at that.
All right, just a quick preview, because you say you'll come back and tell me. You said you never would do anything illegal or inappropriate. I obviously believe you. Were you asked, period, end of story, yes or no, were you asked to do anything inappropriate?
I was never asked to do anything illegal or what I considered immoral. So, again, we'll have another time, another opportunity to dig into those issues, Christiane.
Okay. All right, so now I want to ask you about the U.S. military. You have been yourself, as we all know, a serving member of the Army. You were in the first Gulf War, and you know a lot about the whole, you know, not the profession and also the DOD. What happened with the U.S. military, and did the U.S. military tell the president, many presidents in the last 20 years, the actual truth about what was unfolding on the ground with the Afghan military? We're hearing now, we hear from Craig Whitlock in the Washington Post, you know, we're hearing all sorts of quotes that U.S. military privately harbored fundamental doubts that the Afghan forces would ever be competent. Should the U.S. military have been more forthright with the political leadership?
Well, I can't obviously speak for the last 20 years and four presidents and Lord knows how many other folks involved in the decision making at the time, although I did have a seat from my years in Congress at the time. And I will tell you that I never had a sense that anybody was lying about what was happening in Afghanistan or trying to fool the American people or the political leadership. You know, I was there as early as 2001 on the ground and then made multiple trips in between. And you could see the steady progress of the Afghan army with regard to their capabilities. It was never fast enough, it was never good enough, but they were making progress. And I think maybe it's the nature of the military to see the glass more half full than half empty. But I never had any sense that people were trying to, again, fool the political leaders or to mislead folks. Just the opposite. I think we were, again, very clear-eyed about what we could and could not do. And look, at the end of the day, the United States military paid the heaviest price of any of the Americans in that country, or anybody in that country other than the Afghan people. And I must say our allies, NATO allies, paid heavy prices as well. So I don't think, I have no sense that anybody approached it the way that you described it.
But you are really shocked at the precipitous, you know, collapse, correct?
Oh, yeah, absolutely. But it gets back to what I said up front is the Afghan people never had good leadership, certainly at the top, at the political level. And so if you don't have good leadership, you see will, morale, all those, the moral factors of war that in many ways are far, far more important than the material factors of war, those things slip away. And why mm-hmm. would you expect the Afghan army to fight the way we would expect them to do when their leadership deserts them, literally, you know, President Ghani leaving the country. So
okay.
I was surprised by the speed at which it happened, but given the state of the leadership, it's not surprising to understand why.
So what about the, I think it's something like $83 billion that the U.S. poured into the Afghan forces, and that in the fullness of the total collapse, we have been told that actually some of the issues were that the United States tried to make a U.S.-style, you know, military force there that depended entirely on U.S. equipment, U.S. maintenance, U.S. training, U.S. handholding. Robert Gates, former one of your predecessors, said the one thing they all had in common was that they were, or this is various administrations, was they were all trying to train a Western army instead of figuring out the strengths of the Afghans as a fighting people and then building on that. That's a legitimate piece of analysis, right? I mean, you were trying to stand up successive administrations, something that wasn't Afghan. It was sort of attempting to be American.
Yeah, I think those are important questions that should be teased out, that deserve a lot of closer scrutiny. And maybe we'll do that, or we should do that over the succeeding months and years to understand that. And by the way, it wasn't just the United States training them. It was, our allies training as well. But and it just didn't apply to the military realm. We also imposed a form of government that was, more familiar to us, a centralized form of government, than it was a tribal society such as Afghanistan. So there are a number of areas where we could look at and ask ourselves, did we make the wrong choice, or was this the best of a few worse choices? So I think that needs to be looked at. I think those are serious considerations. But at the end of the day, it doesn't explain what happened over the past week and a half. Again, we should have done a better job anticipating and planning for the withdrawal of Americans, of our Afghan partners, and all those other parts of this that right now have fallen apart before our eyes and are leading to this humanitarian crisis on the ground in Afghanistan.
Secretary Esper, thank you so much for joining us from Arizona. Thank you very much indeed for being with us. Now, of course, as we've said, many are skeptical of the Taliban claims to protect the rights of women and girls, despite their promises at the press conference. Violent and deplorable treatment is something my next guest, Malala Yousafzai, has suffered firsthand. The Nobel Peace Prize winner from Pakistan was just a teenager when the Taliban shot her in the head for going to school. And since then, she's founded the Malala Fund to advocate for girls' education worldwide. She's also graduated from Oxford University, and she's joining me now. Malala Yousafzai, you have been watching what's unfolding in Afghanistan. What do you think, having heard what the Taliban have said today, promises they're making to the women and children, what do you think is going to happen to them? What are your thoughts right now?
Mm-hmm. First of all, I'm deeply concerned about the safety and the future of Afghan sisters. We have heard in the press conference that the Taliban have expressed support towards girls' education and women's rights. However, we are not sure that they will follow these words, and it's just too early to say that they would guarantee that. And I still don't understand the narrative of the Taliban when they say that it has to be according to the Sharia law, because there are dozens of Muslim countries around the world where there is no issue with girls' education, women in jobs, women in journalism. So I'm just wondering how they will define their own Sharia law, because the Sharia law that we saw back in 1996 that they implemented, that did not allow women any rights, that treated women as unequal. Girls were not allowed to be in schools. But also, and the Taliban have admitted it themselves that they made mistakes previously. So I'm worried how many more mistakes are they going to make for women and girls this time.
Mm-hmm. So Malala, let me ask you this, because, as we said, in 2012, you yourself were attacked by Pakistani Taliban. You come from Pakistan, and it was the Pakistani Taliban that shot you in the head. Just remind us of how intense was the disregard for girls and women like yourself, that they would climb aboard a school bus and try to shoot you and kill you for just wanting to go to school. Just remind us of that reality that existed back then.
The Pakistani Taliban actually emerged from the same ideology of the Taliban that started in Afghanistan. The Taliban have a long history. They have many leaders, and they have many small groups. And overall, they work on the same ideology of the so-called spreading of Islam, bringing in their own Sharia law, and actually just silencing women and using force and violence. And that's exactly what they did in Swat Valley when they came in 2007. And they started imposing restrictions on women to go to markets, to do jobs. They announced a ban on girls' education. I was 11 years old at that time, and I could not go to school. I had to hide my books under my scarf. I could not even wear my school uniform because of the fear that if they recognized me as a student, they might attack me, they might throw acid on my face. And there were many bomb blasts, firings every night. So those 2 years were some of the worst years of my life. Those were the darkest days. And it also displaced so many people in Swat Valley. Hundreds and thousands of people became displaced internally within Pakistan because of the military operations that were required after on. And the Pakistan army then pulled out the Taliban from Swat Valley. But the damages that they caused took years and years to recover, and the rehabilitation and reconstruction process is a long process. And that worries me about Afghanistan as well, because Afghanistan has suffered for 4 decades. That's 40 years from one war to another, from one geopolitical war of, you know, some countries are involved and then other countries are involved and other global powers are involved. But the people who suffered the most are the Afghan people. And I'm worried, you know, it will take years and years for the Afghan people to recover from this.
So, Malala, I want to ask you this because you are and you have built yourself a global position as an activist on behalf of women and children. Your own prime minister has commented that the Taliban in Afghanistan have, quote, broken the shackles of slavery. He believes that the Taliban have come to rescue the Afghan people. Now, my question to you is, would you engage the Taliban in your official international role and persuade them to keep the promises that they are now making publicly? We heard from the press conference that they want Afghan women to join the workforce, to join the government, to come back. They say they're a vital, obviously, constituent of Afghanistan. We know that UNICEF is staying in Afghanistan. They say they've had productive meetings with the Taliban and feel that they can continue their work on behalf of children, including female children. Do you believe that you or others could engage with the Taliban in Afghanistan to hold them to their promises?
I think, first of all, regarding breaking the shackles of slavery and atrocities, I think Afghanistan people are still in those shackles. They are suffering from one party and then another, either from terrorist groups or from global wars, either or from proxy wars. So the innocent people of Afghanistan are still in shackles. They have not seen any freedom yet. Regarding the government of the Taliban, I think they are seeking legitimacy right now, and they want the international approval. That is why they are making good statements. And I think it's important for us to remember that we must build pressure on the Taliban. And whether we accept their government or not, that is a separate question, and that is up to world leaders. I am not in that position. I am, you know, I'm a girl just like other girls around the world who want to ensure that their rights are not denied to them just because of their gender, and that they can go to school, they can go to work, they can do their jobs, they can do their professions, and that nobody is dictating to them how they should live their life. That they have, and this is the freedom that has been guaranteed to them within Islam. So, you know, there are just a group of men who will say that, no, let us interpret Islam for you. I think that is something that Islam does not allow either.
Let me play this soundbite from the press conference regarding what they said about Afghan women.
So there will be no violence against women, no discrimination against women. Of course, based within the framework of the Islamic law, our sisters and mothers, which has been said in the Sharia law, our God has said, which is our value, which woman is an important part, tenant of our society.
So, Malala, I think he's saying women are an important part, as I described to you. And also at the press conference, a female journalist stood up and asked very, you know, professionally for them to guarantee rights and what it would look like, etc. We've also seen the female anchor back at her studio on Tolo News actually interviewing a Taliban spokesman in the studio. We've seen a certain Afghan female reporters in the streets in Kabul and actually reporting the news. Does that give you hope?
I think right now the Taliban are admitting that they have made mistakes previously, and they have recognized that Islam cannot deny women their rights and their choices, that they have to be in work and they can have access to education. I think it's just too early to say that they will stick to these promises. It may be that they are that they are either very serious and sincere about it, or it may be that in the coming months it might change. So I think it's important that we keep on building pressure on the Taliban to stick to their promises. I think I hope that what they say, they show it in actions as well, and that no one in Afghanistan is stopped from her dreams and her future. I think, I think there are a few things. Firstly, whether there's saying the right narrative in words, yes, that is correct. But then again, they sometimes talk in very vague terms. They say, we will allow women, but within Sharia law. And as I mentioned earlier, how are they going to define that Sharia law? It varies slightly. There are other countries which have Sharia laws as well. Afghanistan was already an Islamic country, so I'm wondering how are they going to redefine the Islam in Afghanistan. And I think that's something of a concern, and we have to wait how they do that. But regarding how the Taliban came into power, I am for democracy, and I think for me, it has to be the decision of the people through their votes, who they want to be elected, who they want to govern them. So I think that is something in itself, and we need to talk about that separately because, it's important that we recognize that it should be the right of the the people of Afghanistan, that they decide for themselves who should be ruling them. And it's not just, a group of people holding guns and occupying their cities, their towns, making them displaced to tell them that now they will bring somehow a better government for them.
And I just want, to your point, one of the Afghan journalists, female journalist, Anisha Shahid, expressed her concerns, particularly for journalists, because under the last 20 years, actually, information has flourished, journalism has flourished, women have really been part of that, huge new profession in Afghanistan that's built over the last 20 years. Here's Anisha Shahid.
من نگران ای هستم که زحمت 20 سال رسانه ها و مردم افغانستان که کلانترین دستاوردشان آزادی بیان از دست برن. بزرگترین آرزوی من شایدی باشه که من به تمامی ولایت های افغانستان سفر کنم و گزارش از زیبایی ها و بازسازی و آبادی افغانستان نوشته کنم.
Very briefly, Malala, for anybody who's afraid, and as you've seen so many Afghans trying to get out, what do you think Europe and the United States should be doing right now to help those most at risk?
I think, first of all, we stand with the women and girls of Afghanistan. The safety and protection of Afghanistan people should be the top priority right now. And I have spoken to some Afghan activists, and they are raising these concerns that they are at risk, that they need safety. And I ask the international community that they have a responsibility to these individuals and their immediate families. I'm calling on the US, the UK, EU, and others to urgently commit to substantial relocation and settlement programs for the protection of those imminently under threat. They need urgent help, and I also request all the neighboring countries of Afghanistan, including Pakistan, Iran, and Turkmenistan, to open their borders to the Afghan refugees. They need safety. They need protection. They have been displaced, and they are looking for a place where they can feel safe. And I ask other countries globally as well to open their doors. And this is a call to humanity right now.
Thank you for making that call, Malala Yousafzai. Thanks for joining us. It is hard to describe the level of fear and desperation gripping so many Afghans right now. Despite Taliban promises of amnesty for all, people climbing all over each other in a last-ditch attempt to board a flight out of the country. Correspondent Nick Payton-Walsh is in Kabul, and he takes a look at their frantic efforts to escape.
This is the only way out for so many. The airport road jammed, chaos. Over $1 trillion spent, and this is what the end looks like. Walk where you can't drive.
Just ahead of us is the gate into the airport, and this is the panicked scene of many people still moving there despite how hard it's been.
At the entry to the last bit of Afghanistan America controls, there is panic.
They're shouting tanks, right?
Yeah, they say that.
Let's turn around.
Tanks, someone shouts. But who is doing crowd control outside America's evacuation spot? The Taliban. With vehicles they've taken from the Afghan army, paid for by America, now used to keep the desperate crowds back. People whose only hope is to get out, possibly with American help. Crowding at gates, trying to clamber walls originally built to keep an insurgency out. At one time, pushing en masse and being sent running. Nearly every gate with a crowd fueled with the idea this is their only way out. This afternoon, US troops at the perimeter shot dead two Afghans who they said were armed, but later admitted were not Taliban. But inside the airport, the Great Escape was not going according to script, and check-in security had collapsed. Afghans, convinced the promise of a flight out was their only life ahead, clambering over walkways and tarmac the US spent billions on to maintain its presence. And then this startling image, one of the US's largest cargo planes taxiing, laden with Afghans who did not want to be left behind. Later, a plane takes off, and what you're about to see is disturbing. As the plane ascends, two objects, or people, appear to fall from the fuselage. But the sheer scale of those who needed help meant it was even harder to come by. Civilian flights cancelled. Even the Americans had to pause operations till they could regain control. These images from satellites in space showing just the volume of people thronging in and around Hamid Karzai International Airport, the symbol of the United States' billions spent in a 20-year project. The US always wanted to win hearts and minds here, but their swift, unconditional departure has instead filled them with panic.
Now, my next guest also knows firsthand the difficult and often perilous struggle for women and girls' rights. She's not an Afghan woman, but she's America's own Billie Jean King, the veteran tennis champion and tireless social activist who refused to accept unequal treatment for women or people of color from the very start of her brilliant career. King has a new memoir called All In, and it is out today. In it, she writes, "Early on, what was most apparent to me was that the world I wanted didn't exist yet. It would be up to my generation to create it." And so Billie Jean King joins me now from New York about how she helped create that world. Welcome to the program, Billie Jean King. You know, you've been listening to this program and Malala, and you've been watching what's unfolding. And in a way, in a very extreme way, it kind of reflects what you have tried to do all your life since a child for women and girls in the United States. Has that sort of resonated with you over the last couple of days?
Oh, for sure. But all the women and girls and people that have been our allies in Afghanistan, we've got to worry about their safety first, just like Malala said, and protect them and offer them ways to get out. I think it's landlocked, if I have it right. So it's not like they can go out to sea or try to get away that way. So we have to figure out how to protect them, but also for the future of the country. Women have to be an integral part of every phase of the country, just like in government, journalism, et cetera. They have to be. Jobs, whatever.
So, look, let me ask you then, because, you know, talking to Malala and now talking to you, she started as a young kid, but you did as well. You know, you wanted to be a sports girl, you wanted to be a tennis champ, but you also early on identified a world that didn't look like the one you expected it to be, particularly for girls. Yes. And their opportunities. And even while you were, you know, sort of perfecting your sports prowess, you got all sorts of sexist questions about when would you settle down and get married and have kids. How difficult was it for you as a young girl?
Well, compared to women in other countries, I would say it wasn't difficult, but it was difficult in my own small world. And then I knew I was a second-class citizen very early at school. Boys were always called on, always everybody put all their focus on the boys. There are very few sports available to girls. I wanted to be a professional baseball player. Well, only men can play baseball at the professional level, even today. So I got very, very lucky, Christiane, when Susan Williams in fifth grade asked me, "Do you want to play tennis?" I go, what's tennis? So anyway, she got me into it. Then I went out to the public parks where they, with Clyde Walker, where they give free instruction and free access to the courts. And that's the day that changed my life. At the end of that day, I knew I wanted to be the number one player in the world. And then if you fast forward 1 year, when I was 12 and I'm starting to play in tournaments for rankings, I was daydreaming and realized that everybody who played had white shoes and white clothes, played with white balls. And everybody who played tennis that I knew at that time were white. And I asked myself, where is everyone else? And that was my epiphany, the moment I decided I would fight for equality the rest of my life. And in our own little microcosm of life, tennis, we had a lot to do to correct that. It's been a long haul just to correct that, but it also reflects what's going on. And tennis being international has an opportunity to affect the whole world. Every time a player becomes good and people notice them, they have a chance to help their village, they have a chance to help their town, their country, and to be leaders. And they found even in business, women who are on the C-suites, most of them, 94% identify with being an athlete. So we need more CEOs. We need more of everything out there. And women have to be educated just like the boys and everybody else. And no matter how you identify with gender, everyone should be educated. Everybody should be represented in all aspects of society.
You know, clearly from your book and from your life story, it's obvious that you believe sports was also political. So you've explained a little bit about how that was your vehicle. I mean, we're going to talk about the record-breaking championships and your amazing achievement as a tennis player. But you've also become, I would say, you know, legitimately one of the great social and political activists of the 20th and 21st century for your country. You start your book, though, with this really important observation, and you quote the great Supreme Court Justice Ruth Bader Ginsburg. You say that she said, fight for the things that you care about, but do it in a way that will lead others to join you. So how difficult was it for you to do it in a way that would lead others to join you? You knew what you want to create, but you couldn't do it on your own.
No, you cannot do it on your own. And I always felt like I've been on a tightrope, which I think a lot of women and people have felt that they're trying to lead and trying to lead change. Change is difficult. There's no question. People don't like to change. And I was chosen as the leader, really. The women tennis players said, no, you lead. I happen to be number one in the world. That didn't hurt. But I said, no, you do it. And finally, I just said, I'm going to embrace the fact that I am going to be the leader of this change. And in 1979, of us signed a $1 contract with Gladys Hellman. That is the birth of women's professional tennis. Anytime you see a woman get a check or have this platform to talk about issues that are important to them, it's because of that moment in time, because it's still relevant today. So every time a tennis player, woman, gets a check, it's because of that moment in time that we're willing to give up our careers. And the three things that we're willing to do for the future generations was that any girl born in this world, if she was good enough, would finally have a place to compete, that we'd be appreciated for our accomplishments, not only our looks, and number three, most importantly, to be able to make a living, because we all remembered how it was as amateurs making $14 a day, and we never wanted that to happen again. We also fought for equal prize money in the majors. We got that. Why do we fight for that for the rest of the world? Because it sends a message. It's not just about the money. It's about the message of equality for everyone, and every girl, every person in the world should have a chance to experience it. So what's going on in any country, first, safety, protection, but let's get women educated, let them be in positions of leadership. And one thing is a challenge is that when women lead, this is really what irritates me as well. When women lead, they think we're only leading for women. And that is not true. When women lead, they lead for everyone, just like when a male leads. And when a male leads, they never say, oh, he just helped trying to help men. He's a leader for everyone. Same with women. We'll never have a president of the United States. We'll never have more prime ministers and more women at the highest of height unless we think like that. Women lead for everyone, not just girls and women.
You know, again, just to quote, you say, I had heard about the American dream and I thought it applied unconditionally to me. But I realized no matter how good I was, my life would be limited because I was female. And, you know, we all know about the battle of the sexes. That was the most incredible thing. It swept people's imagination. You beat Bobby Riggs, the famous Egyptian litter that you used to enter the arena, the piglet in terms of male chauvinist pig. And as you said, this was more than about a tennis match. What was on the line and what changed for your sport and your political activism for women after winning that match against Bobby Riggs?
Well, it's the exposure I got. It was 90 million people worldwide, so people knew who I was. And first time they'd ever watched tennis for many people. But for the United States, we just passed Title IX a year before in 1972. And for those who don't know what that is, it was the first time that a school, high school or college or university, private or public, received federal funds for the first time. They would have to spend it equally for girls and boys. And that changed everything because people followed the money. A lot of schools that were single gender schools became co-ed quickly because they wanted the money. Also, classroom quotas were finally dismissed because before that, if you wanted to go to Harvard and get a medical degree, only 5% of the classroom was allowed to be women. That's why we had so few lawyers and doctors as women back in the 60s and in the 70s. So that was diminished. We didn't, in 1973, we still couldn't get a credit card on our own. So it's those kinds of things broke down because of that match. It was about social change and we did have it. Also, from a sports point of view, you could not get on a tennis court after that match, which meant just tennis as a sport just exploded. People wanted to be a part of it. They wore tennis clothes all day long, whether they went to the grocery store or whatever they were doing. It was very in and it grew like crazy. But the great thing about tennis and like other sports, some other sports, not all, is that it's global. And that's why we have a chance to affect things because we are global as a sport. And it's important that our top players speak out, which they do. You've seen Naomi Osaka. You've seen Simone Biles. You've seen all the different women athletes speaking out. But women's tennis has always been the leader. We've always led in so many ways on just trying to improve life for everyone. So we're going to continue to do that. We are the leaders in women's sports, tennis. But we have a long way to go still, a very long way. But sports are a microcosm of society. We are a microcosm of society. If you see what's going on in Afghanistan, you hear people talk. That is a reflection of how far we still have to go to improve girls and women's opportunities.
Exactly. So, look, let's just get back to the equal pay issue. You started the first women's pro tour, and then came equal pay. And in the book, you describe an encounter with the director of the U.S. Open somewhere around 1973, in which you negotiated with him while also trying to, you know, win more titles. And you were successful in calling his bluff to an extent over the issue of equal pay. Where do you get the cojones to lay down these negotiating tactics as well as also playing your game?
Well, first of all, back in the old days, Larry King, my former husband, not that Larry King, he and I owned tournaments. So I started to learn the other side of the business, not just playing tennis, but also running events. And in 1972, I said to the U.S. Open people, I know I won't come back next year, and I'm going to talk to the women about not coming back next year unless we get equal prize money. But then I thought about it, and I thought, well, what can we do to help ourselves? And so I went to different people and talked to them behind the scenes about sponsoring and making up the difference in the prize money. And Bristol Myers came through. And so when I went to speak with Billy Talbert, the tournament director, about equal prize money, I brought him the money to make up the difference. Not I did. Bristol Myers did. And I was able to, I could tell that changed everything when he heard that, well, I've already got a sponsor. You won't have to go out and get any more money. We're going to make it easy on you. And Billy Talbert was fantastic. He spoke up. He said, we're going to do it a few months later. And it happened. And I don't even think they voted on it at the USTA, the governing body. of tennis in the United States. So thank you, Billy Talbert, for doing that. I wish you were still alive. I could thank him in person. But anyway, we had equal prize money in 1973. We were the first major tournament, Grand Slam tournament, to do that. And then it took another 34 years. Whew. We finally got Wimbledon and the French in 2007.
Incredible. What a journey. Let's talk a little bit more personally, because not only are you an activist for women's rights, but also now for LGBTQ plus rights. And you yourself grappled with your own sexuality. There was, you mentioned you were married, of course, for a long, long time. And then you were outed after an affair with your hairdresser slash assistant. And it's laid out in graphic detail in your book. And it's quite shocking. You were outed. You didn't choose at that time to come forward. And you suffered all sorts of mental health issues, eating issues, disorders. You went into rehab. But let me just read this, what you say. Still, you describe dealing with your sexuality as, quote, the hardest, longest lasting challenge of your life. You lost your corporate sponsors overnight back in 1981 when you were outed. Give me a sense of how traumatic that was for you and how you still talk about sort of deflecting still that particular issue, despite being out and proud and a major prominent activist for gay rights.
Well, it's been very difficult for me personally. I finally got comfortable at the age of 51, which I talk about in the book. The thing that's good is that when people come to talk to me and with me, and they're being challenged themselves and having trouble, we talk about the shame-based part of this, and this is what gets in the way. Anytime you're shame-based or anytime there's secrets, it doesn't work. And I've had a lot of therapy, and thank God for my therapist, my different ones, that have made such a difference in my life. So all the therapists out there, thank you. And the support systems that are out there. But so I think I'm a good sounding board. I'll listen. But I really want people, when they're ready, to come out. But only when they're ready. I don't think it's really a very fun thing to out. Some people like to do that. I would not do that. Things are so much better now than they used to be in most countries, not all countries, but it's so much better. In the United States, it's definitely a lot better. Now, most of our issues are on our transgender friends and also the youth, 40% more suicides than other groups. And we have a lot of, but it comes back to that shame base, and we must keep changing that, and that people don't judge us by our sexuality. Only, and that people are welcoming, because most people have somebody in their family who's gay, even if they don't know it. There's usually somebody in their family, and it really should not be an impediment in somebody's life, that we should be able to be happy, and everyone should be happy in whoever they are and how they identify by gender or sexuality. Everyone deserves to have the best that life has to offer.
And in the meantime, in the book, you reveal that you married in secret, well, secretly, privately, not secretly,
privately.
But privately, your four-decade partner, Ilana Kloss. And yeah, I'm just wondering why you decided to make that so private and not reveal it until this book has been published.
Well, we wanted something that would just belong to the two of us, because we're so public all the time. You know, we have part ownership in professional teams. We're always out there. We're always, you know, just with a lot of people all the time. And it's like, we said to each other, let's get married. And we definitely wanted Mayor Dinkins, who we adored. He just passed away not too long ago, he and his wife. And we wanted him to marry us, because every time we'd see Mayor Dinkins, he would say, if you ever get married, I'm the one. And so we said, you are the one. And we just loved him so much. So we definitely wanted to get married. I wanted to get married because I didn't want anyone to think that I wasn't totally committed to Ilana, who I adore and love very much. And so I was like, let's just go for it. But Ilana and I decided together to keep it private. We wanted something just for us.
And It's a great story and it's a great book. And we haven't even talked about the tennis, but everybody knows you're a great champion of all time. So Billie Jean King, all in. Thank you so much for joining us with the backstory. That's it for now, of course. You can always catch us online, on our podcast, and across social media. Thank you for watching, and goodbye from London.
Quality sleep is essential, and that's why the Sleep Number Smart Bed is designed for your ever-evolving sleep needs. So you can choose what's right for you whenever you like. Need a bed that's firmer or softer on either side? Helps you sleep at a comfortable temperature. Quiets their snores. Sleep Number does that. Sleep better together. J.D. Power ranks Sleep Number number one in customer satisfaction with mattresses purchased in-store. And now, save 40% on Sleep Number limited edition smart beds for a limited time. For J.D. Power 2023 award information, visit jdpower.com/awards. Only at Sleep Number stores or sleepnumber.com.